Cosmic Shed.
You're listening to The Cosmic Shed, a show that explores the way science and storytelling collide.
We'll be talking about films, books, music, theatre, TV, and anything else that catches our curiosity. From rigorously accurate science fact to ridiculously speculative science fiction.
We don't want to nitpick, but to celebrate the ways science and art can complement and enrich each other.
Mostly, we just want to talk about nerdy things that make us happy.
We've decided to do all of this from a crumbling garden shed somewhere in suburban Bristol.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between. Hello, and welcome to the 8th episode of The Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and with me today are...
Ben.
And...
Becky.
Hang on a second... You're not Laura. So Laura's off exploring. And who are you, Becky?
I am a PhD student at the University of Bristol studying biochemistry.
And today's episode is all about Gattaca, because Becky suggested that we cover Gattaca, and we said, OK, as long as you come and talk to us about it. So, yeah, that's what it's all about. So there's quite a lot of science around Gattaca.
Reproductive biology and the world of genetic engineering.
Brilliant, look forward to that. But first, we have a couple of announcements. Some exciting news.
Yeah.
We have our first patrons.
In the previous episode, we talked a little bit about Patreon, which is a crowdfunding website, and we made a very silly little video on there. A few people have watched it and decided to support us, which we're very thankful for. If you want to have a look at the video and think about supporting us, you can go to patreon.com/thecosmicshed. And a massive thank you to
Ken, Stu and Ty, and a mystery person.
Yeah.
An anonymous donor.
Huge thanks to those people. We will be working on a video for those people and other goodies, so they'll be coming your way very soon.
If you want to know what the video is about, listen to our episode about the Martian. You'll see why you don't want to give money to us.
Oh, you definitely do.
Please don't. No, actually do. But anyway. Oh, and we have a winner of the competition. Mm-hmm. So we had a competition to win Ben's t-shirt that he wore to the Sci-Fi Weekender. And who won it, Ben?
Yep, congratulations to Lauren, who has received her t-shirt.
Do you know, I actually had a message from her, and she said she was wearing her t-shirt to the Dublin leg of Pint of Science.
No way.
Yeah.
You're making that up.
No, it's absolutely true.
Amazing. I like this girl too.
Because you're involved in Pint of Science, aren't you? We've talked about it a bit on the podcast before, but maybe you could tell us a bit about it.
Pint of Science is a science festival, but it is in the pub. So the idea is that we try and tease out the academics and bring them down to the pub to talk to you lovely people about their research. As well as 12 cities in the UK, it's also spread to Europe. So there's some in Spain, France, for example, but it's also gone as far as America now. South America, in fact, as well. So yeah, it's very, very international.
Great.
So we've just missed it this year, but it's back again next May.
It is. It'll be back next May. The third time it will be in Bristol.
More science in the pub. So this episode is all about Gattaca.
Yeah, not a new film. It is available on Netflix and other platforms. We will, of course, be doing a lot of spoilers for the film. If you haven't seen it by now, or if you want a bit of a refresher.
Pause. Okay. Not yet. Wait till we finish this sentence and then come back and listen to the rest. Pause. There must be a point where there's like a spoiler...
amnesty?
Yeah. Is there a spoiler amnesty? Anyone knows, give us a call. It must
I think
be.
20 years might be 20 might be years? Getting there.
Yeah.
Okay, we're nearly there for Gattaca.
So, Gattaca.
Yeah, it came out in 1997.
Written.
And directed by.
Andrew Niccol.
Produced by.
Danny DeVito.
What?
Amongst a lot of other producers. But yeah, this was the time where he was producing a lot of films.
Music by.
Michael Nyman. Starring.
Ethan Hawke.
As Vincent Freeman.
Uma Thurman.
As Irene Cassini.
Jude Law.
As Jerome Eugene Morrow.
Your genes.
No, me gene. Eugene. No, Eugene.
Alan Arkin.
As Detective Hugo.
Rubbish policeman.
Gore Vidal.
As Director Joseph.
with the worst motive.
So Gattaca follows the story of a man called Vincent. And Vincent is one of the last people to be born naturally, so to speak, in this world.
A faith birth.
A faith birth is what they call it.
A god child.
A god child. Almost the social norm in this particular world in Gattaca is that people will pre-screen the embryos and will pick characteristics that are favourable, giving their child the best start in life. It's an example of a film that deals really well with the concept of genetic engineering and what that actually means and kind of what effect that has on people as well. So I really like that aspect of it.
Thanks for bringing it back to our attention. I enjoyed it back when it came out, but I'd forgotten about it, really.
It wasn't a massive hit when it came out. Quite a low-budget film, and I don't think it even was successful on that sort of scale. But it definitely had a sort of cultural impact.
Oh, Ben, have you done a poem?
This week, Andrew asked me to do a poem kind of based around those letters, Gattaca.
So Gattaca is called Gattaca because basically it is a word, I suppose a nonsense word, that one could make up from the letters that are in the genetic code. So A, T, G and C, which stand for things we call nucleotides, which are in DNA, which is the building blocks of DNA.
It's called Gattaca because cat tag isn't a good name for
cat
a film.
Cat tag is not
a good name. Yeah, attack gag. Yeah, Andrew asked me to do something with those letters, so I chose, of course, an acrostic poem where you take a word and make the lines of the poem begin or end with those letters. I thought I'd try a sort of double challenge and do a double acrostic. I don't know if that's a real term, but that's what I'm calling it. I've done the beginning and end of the lines both spell out Gattaca, but in reverse order. So it's kind of a double helix poem. Possibly. I didn't have much time for this one, so it was a bit rushed. It kind of goes a bit wrong at the end. Maybe like this film, I don't know. My double helix acrostic poem is a bit like this. Georgina, in the not too distant future, becomes deeply enamoured of Alana. Alana grows rather fond of Georgina too, but also quite likes Mark. Though he loves Alana as a friend, Mark secretly pines for Georgina. Together, they are sent by their Fortune 500 company for a genome sequencing test. After the test, Alana and Mark celebrate, while Georgina remains quiet. Congratulating her friends on their flawless results, she buys them beer and pizza. Accepting her imperfections, Georgina realises that she could never truly have loved anyone who put so much stock in nucleotides and instead goes on to have a long-lasting, mutually supportive relationship with a primary school teacher called Morag.
Thanks, Ben.
The only way I could really see that in my head is near like on Star Wars, where they have like the words going up. That's literally what I had in my head, was trying to work out how you did the letters.
Well, you didn't spoil the film at all with the poem, Ben.
No, I was thinking about the world of Gattaca, sort of, you know, the kind of dating scenarios that might happen. In that world.
You were sort of extending the world beyond...
Yeah, there's a really nice scene where Uma Thurman goes to a sort of booth and she gives a lock of what she thinks is Ethan Hawke's, Vincent's hair, which is in fact Jude Law's character's hair. But he gives it to a booth and then she immediately gets a report on his genetic sequence. And this is obviously something people use for kind of dating purposes to see if their paramour is genetically acceptable. There's another character who comes and gets a swab of their lips. She's just kissed someone, testing out the kind of compatibility of her mate. Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman's character have heart defects, so they feel inferior, not in the, just in the job market, but also in terms of dating as well, because that's the implication, that they're kind of inferior models.
So what I really, really like about the film is the fact that it deals very well with the ethical issues of the science that's going on. The big problem with this, I guess, society that the film creates is that you have a new kind of discrimination, which is not technically legal in the film, but it still happens. People easily ignore it. And it's the essence that if you are sort of genetically chosen and pre-screened and, you know, that's the traits you have, then you are superior. They say you're superior genetically to the ones that aren't, so you're called a valid as opposed to an invalid. So Vincent is an example of an invalid. But in the end, actually, Vincent, despite being genetically inferior, so to speak, he actually has this real determination to achieve his dream. And I think the film does a really good way of showing that essentially you can't engineer human spirit. You can't have a, you don't have a gene for determination, or at least as far as we know. And in the end, that can be more important. So ultimately, he does achieve his dream just through hard grind.
Well, by deception and criminality as well.
Yeah. Yes, and also just, by being a bit cheeky about it, really.
It is kind of, in a way, quite a perfect film for me, because it's quite peaceful, it's quite slow, it's quite considered, and it's about a nerd trying to get into space. I would very happily spend any afternoon watching it.
Yeah, quite a steady pace, there's tension throughout, but it doesn't ramp up that tension in many sequences. It doesn't focus on that as a thriller, it focuses on the details, which is what I really liked about it, I think, especially the initial sequence when you just see Vincent kind of going about his quite bizarre daily ritual, getting the bags of urine, strapping it to his legs, scrubbing himself down for any stray skin cells and hair follicles. I really enjoyed those details and sort of piecing it together. Eventually there is a voiceover which kind of perhaps over-explains those things, but that early sequence was really nice. And by making that very specific world that they focus on, yeah, it does create really interesting tension. I kind of enjoy the mood of the film that's set up from the beginning. The title sequence is lovely and disgusting at the same time. You've got these extreme close-ups of fingernails being clipped and falling down and skin cells and hair in extreme close-up. And it kind of looks beautiful to start with, and you kind of realise what's going on. Gives you a real awareness of all those bodily things and all the sort of untidiness of our bodies. And I really enjoy that kind of physicality.
A lot of thought been put into the sets and everything. And that, the double helix staircase.
Is it a double helix?
Could you have a double helix staircase?
Yeah, you just have two. Sort of,
I guess, out. So, yeah. Definitely.
It's like a ladder.
Well, yeah.
A twisty ladder.
Yeah.
Which would be really hard to get up.
Yeah, but you can have a race. Like, Jude Law and Ethan Hawke could race each other up.
Speaking about it makes it feel more laboured than it actually was.
Yeah.
But that metaphor, that symbolism, is really quite well done at times.
Yeah, a lot of concrete, very minimal interiors, which is very late 90s. It definitely reminds you of a lot of other things at that time. The filters, the different coloured filters they use for the flashbacks, again, was pretty fashionable at that time. They haven't gone for elaborate futuristic costumes. They've gone for this very retro futuristic style with sort of 20s style, like double-breasted pinstripe suits, which gives it a sort of otherworldly sort of quality. Maybe it's overcomplicating it, but maybe it's like an alternative reality version of the future. If you kind of branch from the 20s or the 30s and just take this one technology of genetic engineering and sort of follow that path without kind of worrying too much about anything else, really.
Yeah, I like that, because they do focus very much in on that one aspect. They don't really talk about much about the world as a whole. It's very much that specific situation that Vincent is in. You get much more invested in the characters that they do focus on. So I think on the face of it, when you meet Vincent and when you meet Jerome particularly, I didn't really like them as characters when I first met them, but I think once you become invested in their purpose, I think there are some really, really great moments in there, particularly when Jerome and Vincent become very close. Moments of humour in there, even though it's quite a sort of a deadpan film in many ways.
They're all very well cast together. They've all got that strange, sort of slightly otherworldly coldness to them. They're not warm actors. They've chosen that very carefully to go with the aesthetic, to go with that Michael Nyman score. It's all kind of a piece.
One other thing that I really enjoyed was that they're going to Titan, and of course in 1997 they didn't know what was beneath Titan's clouds, and of course we do now because of the Cassini-Huygens probe in 2004. What Ethan Hawke or Vincent would have found is a pretty inhospitable place, which looks a lot like Earth from a distance, but is actually it's the only body in the solar system that we know of that's actually got liquid lakes, rivers and rain, but they're not made of water. They're made because of the extreme pressure, liquid methane. So the gas that we know of as methane is in a liquid state on Titan. And there may well be life in those lakes that's based on something other than what we are, but Ethan Hawke wouldn't survive very well there.
Could we genetically modify people to survive there, though?
Becky?
I hope that we could. It'd be awesome. Yeah. But I just don't know. Maybe.
Gattaca 2.
Gattaca 2.
Is that something that you could work on for us?
Yeah, I think that might be the title of my next grant proposal for research. Yeah, I want to engineer
the new Titans.
Titanians.
One thing I really remember from the first viewing was the sequence where Vincent has to cross the street to get over to Irene, Uma Thurman's character. He's thrown away his contact lenses, and I remember that being, yeah, just something very, a very strong visual for someone who is myopic, and just a big fear of kind of being out of, you know, losing control and not having that security of your glasses or your contact lenses. Mm. It's really overdone. The visual is, you know, hugely overdone in the film, of course.
Yeah, yeah. That's not what it looks like when you take your glasses.
Well, not quite. But then, you know, I'm not Ethan Hawke. And the cars, kind of, the sound of the cars whizzing past, very tightly shot. So you just see it from his perspective. So it is, yeah, it's terrifying. Yeah. It's a really effective sequence.
Would you ever take your glasses off and play a game of real-life Frogger?
I generally tend not to take my glasses off anyway, like even in the shower. You just never know.
Another thing I find really interesting about the film is their use of pairing the two brothers. So Anton, so this is Vincent's brother who has been sort of genetically chosen. Him and Anton have this kind of swimming race right from when they're very little to when they're adults, where they try and outswim each other into the sea. And then eventually Vincent does beat Anton, and Anton actually almost starts to drown, and Vincent drags his brother back to shore. And that's the beginning of him starting to break away from the family and leaves home after that.
I guess it's the idea that Vincent had to fight for what he wanted. It kind of made him stronger. Anton was given everything and maybe was quite complacent about that.
I mean, it's almost stupid, really. I mean, at the end of the film, you know, the two grown adults are kind of going into the sea at night, but somehow it feels relevant at that point in the story because it's so scary and so it kind of feels like the ultimate race.
And they kind of use the visual of the sea to mirror space. I think it's got a kind of short story quality that everything is chosen very specifically to be a symbol, to be a metaphor. That's a strength, definitely, that it is so focused. But it, as a feature length, even quite a short feature length, you do start to unpick those plot points. It sort of gets a bit thinly stretched, I think, at some points.
I like the metaphor of the swimming. I like what they're doing with it, but it doesn't fit at the end of the story for me, within the context of me really enjoying it. I don't really buy the sibling rivalry between the two of them. I don't think that's particularly well done.
They obviously want it to be this big twist reveal that, oh, it was Anton all along.
Yeah,
it's a bit of a film noir thing as well,
I think. It's a weird thing.
That everything is kind of predetermined, everything is connected. But then you don't get any of his motivation, you don't really get anything from his point of view.
From looking at this script, it looks like there was a lot more of the world that we don't see. And one of the deleted scenes, Anton goes to see a prostitute. The prostitutes are all invalids. It's painting that sort of wider world picture, which we don't really get. It's like everybody works at NASA, I mean Gattaca, and either as a cleaner or as an astronaut.
Yeah. In that particular case, I guess it's probably the right choice to cut out that scene. It's getting into very dicey territory, showing sex workers as lower cased. Good choice, I think, on their part. The very final image of the film, Vincent is heading off to space. He's kind of got his dream, but he's had to leave Uma Thurman behind. So maybe his dream is a little bit bittersweet in the end. And then we see Jerome climbing into the incinerator with his silver medal. He had all the advantages, but he still came second
despite
in
his favourable genetic predisposition.
And he's tried to commit suicide before. We know this in the film. That's how he ended up in the wheelchair. It's very neat, of course, the final sequence. This brings it all back to the beginning and the incinerator, which was one of the first images.
Again, it's probably just another illustration that, you know, there are certain things you can't control in life. And I think they actually say in the film there is no gene for fate. So despite the fact he had that amazing genetic predisposition, actually in the end he ended up not being very happy at all, particularly because he achieved what he thought was less than perfect, which was the silver medal. The fact that then led him to be depressed enough to throw himself in front of a car, I mean, obviously there's probably a multitude of factors. I almost find it a bit irritating that Jerome commits suicide in the end, because when you first meet Jerome, he's a sort of very cynical guy, very cold, and, you know, I didn't really particularly like him when you first get introduced to him, but throughout the film, he really sort of buys into Vincent's dream, and in the end, he's really trying hard. I mean, evidenced by the fact that he pulls himself off a staircase with just his arms, just so that he doesn't risk exposing Vincent. And you think at that point, it's almost like he's got a reason to kind of, he's got this friendship almost, this kind of this reason to do it. And granted, at the end of the film, that reason kind of leaves, it's, you know, physically leaves, goes up into space. But you feel like he's got more of a personality then, and kind of more kind of determination. And yet it feels sad that suddenly he's like, okay, right, I'm just going to burn myself.
Yeah.
His motivations feel a bit muddy for me throughout. Like, his motivation is to keep him in the... in the life to which he's been accustomed.
Yeah.
And it's to keep him in the life of sitting around not doing anything in his flat.
But a very cool concrete bunker style, like modernist flat, yeah. You know.
Like, I really need loads of money so I can sit in this house and not do anything.
He drinks a lot as well.
It's not that much.
It goes back to the sort of narrowness of the world. You can imagine in a hugely advanced society, they could just fix his legs, surely.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's no kind of other tech that really exists in the world.
Well, I mean, Ethan Hawke gets his legs extended and then they work again, so surely they can fix his legs.
He could be playing wheelchair basketball or any number of sports and fighting for that gold medal. So maybe that would have been a more optimistic film, would have ended on him trying out for some kind of wheelchair sport and taking inspiration from Ethan Hawke.
The only thing I can think of is that, I suppose all the way through, is that he's burning all the forensic evidence. And so in some ways it feels like he's the last bit of forensic evidence.
It doesn't matter if he gets found now, because he's already gone off to space. Mm-hmm. The other motivation, which I don't understand at all, is the killer. I mean, why does he kill him?
So the plot can work. It's just one of those things.
I really want to someone else to go to Titan, so I'm going to kill someone who doesn't want it to happen. It's just ridiculous.
Watching it back, I didn't remember that. I was waiting for the twist where Uma Thurman was the murderer. Irene is an undercover invalid as well, and then something. Yeah, right. It's a very weird twist. But again, I think in a shorter film or something which had more momentum, you kind of wouldn't question that so much. But because it's presented you just like that, you're just kind of given it by Alan Arkin. Mm. I really enjoyed that the FBI agents were referred to as Hoovers in the film, and they have little Hoovers, which would be lost to American viewers, because I don't think Hoover is used to mean vacuum cleaner in America. But that's quite enough. That it's just referring to J. Edgar.
I'd love a forensic scientist's point of view on the film as well. Just because sometimes I mean, one of my really good friends is a forensic scientist, or was, and I can just imagine her being like, you know, the amount of cleaning they do, there's just going to be bits of him all around the place, even though he scrubs mercilessly every morning.
Yeah. And the other thing I don't understand is, what, there's 12 launches a day, where are they going? You can only get to somewhere near
Paris,
Saturn.
New York, York,
Australia.
Yeah.
But I mean, you could only get to Saturn every 70 years, presumably.
Well, Titan specifically.
Yeah, Titan specifically. Where are they going? 12 a day. It's amazing. But it doesn't matter. Because it's fun.
It's one of those films where, as long as you're with it, as long as you're in the mood and the tension of the film, you can sort of suspend your disbelief. But there are definitely other opportunities to show more of the world outside. There's a point when one of the characters talks about, I think it's in Ethan Hawke's voiceover, talking about the genetic modifications creating a new underclass. That didn't seem to be followed through at all, really. There's a brief scene where the cops are kind of rounding up people. What is the difference between people being poor and not being able to afford the genetic modifications and just being poor? You know, what exactly has that changed in society?
It makes transition between the classes more difficult, but doesn't actually create a new class.
There is a kind of an undertone, though. So right at the beginning, the doctor who's advising Vincent's parent, he is black, and there's almost like a kind of a point where, as I say, we specified fair, but there's like a look on his face that almost says to you, okay, well, this, you know, discrimination with race and colour doesn't really exist anymore, but it's like, maybe it is still there slightly, because it's almost like people are picking not to have...
Mm.
I don't know if that's true or not, maybe I read too much into that.
Yeah, I don't know if it's intentional, but it's certainly... If you're making a film about eugenics, it's probably something you would do intentionally, isn't it?
Eugenics has become a poison term.
It's something that we link with Nazi Germany.
I think when people think of eugenics, they do think of, you know, engineering people with blonde hair and blue eyes or something like that, when actually what you're really talking about is a process where you could, in theory, I'm not saying we should do it all the time necessarily, but in theory, if it works, you could stop, well, you could lessen the prevalence of certain diseases, for example. So, for example, Huntington's disease. If you have a mutation in the gene that gives rise to Huntington's disease, it's very likely it might be 100% likely of get the disease. Say if you kept selecting for people that didn't have that mutation, in theory, if that happened worldwide, you could essentially get rid of Huntington's disease. I mean, there's always a chance that gene could mutate spontaneously again, but effectively you are reducing the prevalence of certain diseases, or you could do, in theory. Yeah. So that in itself might not be a bad thing, but I think it's a slippery slope. You know, where's the line between when you should and shouldn't select, and kind of just because someone has a disease, does that mean they can't function or can't be happy? It gets very twisted then, and very, very difficult to figure out what should be done as opposed to what can be done.
Yeah. There's sort of the two sides to it. There's the science of it, and then there's the social policy of it. And the social policy of it seems to be all wrong to me, whereas the science, you can see an argument for some of it, as you say. But apart from the fact that genes aren't as simple as they thought they were back then, and it's not like you can just switch that one off and turn to it for most things, it seems. Genetics is quite often portrayed, at least, as being quite complicated. Since we've got you here, what is a gene?
So the definition of a gene does occasionally wobble a bit in the scientific literature, but my understanding of a gene, it is a sequence of DNA that produces a protein in a cell, and a protein is just a molecule in a cell that does something. It's something that produces a functional molecule, essentially, or not necessarily functional, but a molecule in the cell. That is a gene. The genome is all the genetic material in one particular organism. So you can have a human genome. There is Andrew's genome, there is Ben's genome, and there is my genome. But you can talk about a human genome as being kind of a thing in itself. It's just that every person has a little bit of variation on it. We talk about other animals' genomes. So, like, for example, we work a lot on fruit flies. They have their own genome, as do bacteria. You know, for example, they have their own genome. And it's just all the genetic material in that organism.
What's a double helix?
The double helix is the term we use for explaining the structure of DNA, essentially, and all it really is two, if you can imagine, just two chains of blocks, essentially, and in this case I'm talking about a string of nucleotides, which is the building blocks of DNA. If you just imagine that there's two strands of it, it's just the way that the molecules orientate themselves, and that is just based on their chemistry. Their basic chemistry allows them to form that kind of, I guess what you call a favourable shape, and that's the shape that they choose to adopt, and it's an amazing structure, really, and it's perfectly built to its purpose. It's quite stable. It has this fantastic ability to be pulled apart at the right time, so you can actually unzip that helix and replicate it, so that then you can have cell division, you can have growth, I guess, of an organism. But then equally, when it is DNA zipped together, it is actually inherently quite stable. In your DNA, you don't just have genes. There are other sequences in your genome that don't produce proteins, that don't produce things in the cell, but that just influence genes. You can get another version of DNA, which is called RNA, which actually the only difference between RNA and DNA is just one sort of chemical group on that nucleotide, really. For whatever reason, that makes that molecule less stable, and it means that it doesn't hold together as well. And so in the cell, that molecule is used for other purposes, and exists in human cells, and it can exist as a kind of a single strand. So this double helix kind of structure, it can exist as a single strand, and that can float about in the cell and can do other functions. So for example, when you have DNA to make a protein, so I said that a gene is something that makes a protein, you unzip the helix and the cell will actually make messenger RNA sequence, which is basically just an RNA sequence built from that DNA sequence. So they're very similar, right? So basically what you could do is you can make an RNA copy of that gene and then send it off to other parts of the cell where it can be made into a protein. So your DNA never leaves the nucleus, but that RNA can go out into the cell and be used to make that protein. What's fascinating about the genome is that it's all kind of bunched up in the cell. You could have a sequence that is miles and miles away, not literally, but you know, it's a long, long way away from that gene sequence, but that could actually have an effect on the gene. So for example, we talk about gene expression, all that means whether that gene is switched on or off. There are sequences in the DNA that can affect the expression of a gene, and therefore can affect that protein in the cell and can then mean, for example, you might get a disease from that way rather than by necessarily having a faulty gene to start with. It might be that there's actually something else at play there. It's what we used to think of as junk DNA. Scientists have known for a long time that there are genes in the DNA, but there's lots of other stuff that we don't know about. Some people thought it was just genes that we hadn't discovered yet, but actually it's becoming more and more apparent that actually they're not genes. They're sequences, and they largely outnumber the genes. I mean, we talk about the genes being a very, very small percentage of the genome. But the rest of it is what we call junk DNA, but it's not, perhaps it should be called not so junk DNA. In some ways, it might be more important than the genes.
So it's kind of like dark matter in our bodies.
Yeah, I guess that might be a good way of looking at it. It's kind of this elusive thing, really, that people are finding out more and more about, but means that our DNA doesn't always give the result that we expect it to. And I think that's one of the problems with genetic manipulation, is that when you take it in the context of a whole organism, it doesn't necessarily play out the way you think. So this idea of having this control, you know, for example, in the Gattaca situation, doesn't necessarily ring true once you actually have that whole organism later in life. So my research was really, so what I was doing is I wasn't really working in the lab on it, I was actually doing a literature review. So I was reviewing what was known so far about junk DNA, and it was absolutely fascinating. It was probably one of the most interesting things I've ever looked into, because there is so much that we don't know about it, and we've started to come up with all these different classes of genetic material that are not genes, that perform other functions. One of my particular favourites is the concept of a jumping gene. So it's a real thing. It's called jumping genes. So we call them transposons in sort of science speak. These genes have the ability to cut themselves out of your DNA and move somewhere else in your genome.
What?
They're very odd. They're not genes. They're not, you know, they don't produce proteins themselves, but you can imagine how that might have some very, well, potentially bad consequences. It could insert itself into a random gene randomly and then mess up that whole system.
Just for fun.
Just for fun. but equally, it could give rise to a whole new thing, couldn't it? It could generate a whole new version of a gene, for example. There's many sort of theories as to why it happens. One is that it's one of the mechanisms for ways of making that kind of genetic diversity, I guess. It's sort of, in some ways, it might be favourable to kind of occasionally really, really sort of mess about with the DNA. It's a very weird concept, but again, this is just an example of one of the things we just didn't know about before. Yeah. We didn't know that happened.
These jumping genes, do they cause mutations? Is that what you're saying?
I suppose a mutation is just a change in the DNA sequence. So yeah. Usually you think of mutations as something where a particular nucleotide has been changed to something else. So I suppose what I'm talking about, by my own definition, really mutation as such, it's a genetic rearrangement. For me, it's just an example of actually our genome being very dynamic. The way we think of our genome as being this kind of concrete genetic sequence isn't necessarily true all of the time.
In Gattaca, there's a gene, or a set of genes perhaps, for violence and violent behaviour. That's just nonsense, isn't it?
It might be that in decades to come, we might discover that there are genes that predispose people to certain things. But at the moment, we really know next to nothing about how your personality, I suppose, is formed, or whether that really has a genetic component. Around the time of Gattaca, IVF was already an established technique. But they started to talk about another technique called PGD, which stands for pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And essentially, that's where, when they've already fertilised and made the beginnings of an embryo, they can actually take a few of those cells away, then screen those cells for the genetic defects, which they might be talking about in the film. So it was quite a good time to have the film, almost, because it was being talked about.
Just a few quotes from an article from Scientific American. The starting point of the article was, are we getting too close to the science of Gattaca? And some quotes from Tanya Simoncelli, Assistant Director for Forensic Sciences within the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Back in 2003, so it's obviously moved forward from this quite a lot, unfettered development of PGD applications is providing parents and fertility specialists an increasing and unprecedented level of control over the genetic makeup of their children. Advances in PGD, together with cloning and genetic engineering, are tending towards a new era of eugenics. Unlike the state-sponsored eugenics of the Nazi era, this new eugenics is an individual, market-based eugenics where children are increasingly regarded as made-to-order consumer products.
Technologically, we're still advancing all the time. We're still finding out what different genes do. And I suppose our ability to screen for more and more things is getting better and better. But I think ethically and morally, we haven't necessarily moved that far forward. I think it's still a bit of a weird one to talk about with people, this concept of designer babies. When people screen for things like diseases, that doesn't mean they're also going to be like, oh, we'd like a child with blue eyes or brown hair. Sometimes they're just simply asking, you know, so maybe one of the parents has a really high chance of developing or does have, for example, muscular dystrophy, for example, which again is another one of those diseases caused by one or two genes. It's quite easy to figure out whether someone may or may not have it in the future. Is it a problem to necessarily choose, I would say choose lightly, an embryo which has a, you know, has a possibility of not getting that disease, so therefore, you know, potentially improving their quality of life? There are lots of traits you could screen for, and you can, in principle, select certain physical traits that we know about. The tricky thing here is that whereas some diseases, for example, some characteristics rely on one single gene, other characteristics, and eye colour is one of them, is actually what we call polygenic, and it just means that it relies on several different genes, or, you know, a couple of genes. So it's not quite as simple as saying, okay, they've got that gene, therefore they're going to have blue eyes. But you could probably now make a kind of an educated guess as to what they might have looking at the combination. I think it's a good thing to highlight that actually it's not always that simple. You can have a picture of the human genome being kind of this set of Lego blocks where, you know, if you have one particular thing, you're definitely going to have this or that. But it in reality, it's not quite that simple. And there are so many factors in the human genome that can affect that. Even if you have the right set of genes, for example, you can have various outside influences, environmental factors that can affect how that gene is effectively used in your body, whether it ends up producing that characteristic or not, essentially.
So if there isn't a gene for violent behaviour and there isn't a gene for characteristics, and really all we can do is select to not have particular diseases, then is there anything wrong with the science of it?
It's a very difficult thing to come down either side of for me. From a purely objective point of view, I think that it would be really nice if there were certain diseases that we could effectively eradicate simply through choosing embryos that don't have that sort of faulty gene, etc. But there are a couple of complications with that, and I think the first thing is I wonder if we would ever get to a stage where we could eradicate many serious diseases at all. I mean, I'm thinking particularly of something like cancer, which is very much a part basic genetic defect, but in other senses also something that you accumulate over your life. So it's like an outside influence. So really, I don't really think you could ever get to a point where you know, with some diseases at least, we completely eradicate them. But with some, so I alluded earlier to Huntington's disease, I reckon you could make great progress with something like that. Or Parkinson's disease, or maybe eventually when we get there, something like Alzheimer's. So that's one thing. So I think from purely a disease point of view, I think it's a very interesting concept, and I think it's something that could be considered. I guess the problem, as it always is with science, is this sort of the moral and ethical implications of that. So, for example, they sometimes talk about Down syndrome as being one of those diseases where we know very clearly what the genetic defect is with Down syndrome, so we can very easily select that out effectively of the population. But I say easily. In theory, you know, we could pre-screen embryos and, you know, we could reduce the prevalence, let's say, of Down syndrome. But many people would argue that actually just because someone has a disease, does that necessarily affect their quality of life? Does it mean that we shouldn't give that embryo a chance to live? And I'm just thinking of all the people, all the fantastic people in the world who do live with these diseases, you know, people that are currently, not saying this defines people, but, you know, have been some amazing people who live through these, like Stephen Hawking, for example, has a pretty terrible form of multiple sclerosis, but he somehow has sort of dealt with his life in a really good way. So you're kind of basically trying to say, well, if you have a disease, it means you're not going to be good for anything. But yeah, that's not necessarily true, is it?
Wasn't that part of Gattaca originally?
On the original screening, they had a series of pictures of people come up at the end of the film that if you selected these people, wouldn't have existed. Exactly that argument. And you wouldn't have existed. And when they did that screening, the audience said that was too close to home, and then they took it off from the actual film.
It's a good example of an extreme version of what we have, if you see what I mean. So it's kind of like, it takes it to an extreme. So it's kind of based on truth. I like it because of that. But actually, you have to bear in mind, we're not there yet.
Of course. It does feel like the film is kind of been made as a warning against those extremes. And you kind of you do feel the message very heavily in the film. This does seem to be a technology which is advancing really quickly. Obviously, the genome sequencing is continuing all the time. Mm. There is a service, there are quite a few services. One of them is 23andMe, which is a company that you can pay, I think it's £125. They'll send you a container to spit into, and then you send it back. And then in 4 to 6 weeks, you get a report on health risks you might face throughout your life. You also get an ancestral report. And that is, at the moment, a totally legal service in the UK. It's being legislated in the US, I think. I think the FDA has kind of stopped them doing the health report. But yeah, so you can do that. You can get that report. And their main reasoning for that is so people can sort of engage with their own health and make choices based on that report. So it's not necessarily that you can fix all the problems. It's that you can change your lifestyle, change your diet, exercise, regime, all this kind of stuff in a targeted way, giving you access to your data about yourself.
Well, that begs a question, Ben. Why haven't you done it?
£125 seems...
it's purely financial.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm quite intrigued by that.
Sometimes I think it would be kind of cool and interesting to find out, but I think the minute I contemplate actually doing it, I just chicken out. I think part of me doesn't want to know if I have a high risk of having a certain disease. Mm. I mean, it almost sounds illogical in a way. Why wouldn't I want to know so that I can do something about it? But at the same time, would I want it to really be hanging over me that whole time?
Like Vincent in the film, he's told he's got these things and he's treated as though he's got those things. When you get that message that you might have a heart problem, you're going to worry that you've got a heart problem, aren't you? And that's why I wouldn't do it, is I can't see what I would learn that would be of great benefit, but I can see what I would learn that would be detrimental.
Right.
You know, you could find out that you've got a 99% chance of something very bad that you can't do anything about, and what good does that
mean? Well, and then also it's the idea of passing that on to potential offspring. As podcast fans, it's something we've heard a lot about, because 23andMe at least in the UK, advertises on quite a few podcasts, and it's something, you know, it's quite a high profile company. This is something which we're obviously going to see much more of in the future, something to kind of keep an eye on.
Maybe you should do like live reaction to someone getting their results from 23andMe.
Well, if we get £125 worth of pledges, I'll do it. I'll be the guinea pig. I'll spit into that test tube.
Support The Cosmic Shed now at patreon.com/thecosmicshed to find out how Ben is going to die. In Gattaca, there's a piano recital.
Yeah.
It's a fairly reasonable piece of piano music that's played, and then everybody enthuses about how he could possibly have played it, and it turns out that he has 12 fingers. That's his genetic modification, the pianist. What piece of music would you like to see in that place? What piece of music actually feels like you need 12 fingers to play it?
If anybody has ever listened to Dragon Force here, or any of our listeners have listened to Dragon Force, let me just explain. The Dragon Force is, I guess, a metal... I'm not very good with music genres, but it's kind of metal, very, very, very fast-paced metal. And there are some guitar solos in there which I don't even understand how they're played by a human being. It's kind of one of those songs, or one of those types of song, that is kind of the epitome and kind of the holy grail of Guitar Hero. If you can play that on Guitar Hero, you are officially a maestro of Guitar Hero. Anyway, if you want to listen to something which, you know, you think could be played by someone with 12 fingers, I would suggest listening to Dragon Force Through the Fire and Flames.
flames of dancing turn to rain. We ride towards the fire. You know for a fact that they only have 10 fingers.
Do you know, I don't actually know that for a fact, but I'm pretty sure if I went back to the videos, there would be 10 fingers.
But they've been moving so quickly.
So quickly that you just wouldn't know.
I mean, could be 20.
Yeah, exactly.
So, great, that's sort of an argument for just sticking to music that is 10-fingered, isn't it, really?
Because, you
know, not necessarily better.
No, not necessarily. See what you think.
But more.
You mentioned the Frogger scene, Ben.
The crossing the road to get to the other side, to get to Uma Thurman. Was she in Frogger?
I think she might have been. The pixels weren't that clear.
Yeah.
Frogger, for our younger listeners, is a 1980s arcade game where you had to try and cross the road.
Yeah.
A frog crossing the road.
Yeah. There are loads of versions. You can get loads of versions of it. Your phone now.
Right. I was just wondering, Ben, are there other computer games that you'd like to see represented in film?
I just saw a trailer for Pixels, which seems to feature a life, well, bigger than life, well, enormous Pac-Man coming to the streets. It looks like either the greatest film ever made or the complete death of culture. I'm not quite sure. On one level, video and arcade games coming to real life. And it features Peter Dinklage, hooray. On the other level, it seems to star Adam Sandler. So I'm not making any... I've no idea. It's a baffling film. Baffling that it's been made. But it exists. It exists.
You lost me at Adam Sandler.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Punch Drunk Love. I don't think it's the next Punch Drunk Love. It looks very weird anyway. So yeah, Pac-Man has been brought to life in lots of different ways. Whole city-wide Pac-Man games that have happened. It came to Google Maps earlier this year.
Yep.
So yeah, I'd be up for a bit of Pac-Man. Final thoughts on Gattaca? Perhaps flawed,
but ultimately a really interesting message and based on, if not true to, a very interesting branch of science.
Gattaca actually came out top of the films that NASA rates as the most scientifically accurate. And they also announced that Armageddon was the least.
Right. So we're doing Armageddon next episode. that's the cause of my death, I've realised.
Oh no!
If a Michael Bay film is ever discussed in the Cosmic Shed in a serious manner, that's it. It's all over.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's about all we've got time for. But before we go...
You can support the Cosmic Shed in a number of different ways now. You can sign up to a free trial at Audible and get a free audiobook of your choice. For this episode, perhaps we would suggest Brave New World. There's an audiobook of that there. Aldous Huxley's classic. His brother was a big eugenicist. A lot of the science of the time was kind of put into that book. Really interesting if you haven't read it.
That's audibletrial.com/thecosmicshed.
Yeah. Another book which might be interesting, I haven't tried the audiobook of it, is one of Michael Crichton's last books, which was called Next. Obviously, Michael Crichton always kind of had his finger somewhere near the pulse of current science technology. That was written in the late noughties, just before his death, I believe. Mm. Not his last book, but the last book that was published before his death. And that's called Next.
Audibletrial.com/thecosmicshed.
Yeah, and if you do sign up to that, then we get a little tiny morsel of support from Audible. Also, if you, again, have a look at Patreon... which you can find at patreon.com/thecosmicshed. You can have a look at a very silly video showing the interior of the shed and Andrew, Laura and I in our matching Cosmic Shed t-shirts.
You can find us on Facebook.
Follow us on Twitter at The Cosmic Shed.
You can subscribe at iTunes and other podcast platforms.
Visit thecosmicshed.com
for more information and all our episodes.
Thank you so much, Becky, for coming to join us. Absolutely fascinating.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Hey, no lots problem. More questions, I think.
Yeah,
we're going to ask.
Yeah, we're
going to
get you back.
Yay.
And thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
I don't know, Becky. Dragon Force, they sound great, but they're probably not on the internet anywhere. So just in case we can't get a clip, could you sing one of their songs for us? Or just do the guitar solo. As you're sitting there with your Dragon Force t-shirt on... Wow. That was at least 12 fingers, yeah.
14. Oh,